Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we welcome Steve Trovato. We'll be speaking with Steve about country licks and how they've inspired us from rock to jazz. Steve is a professor at USC and has written many instructional books on guitar that have been published by the likes of Hal Leonard and many others. Flow Guitar Enthusiast is proudly sponsored by Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio at www.sweetwater.com. And now here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. We have a really killer show for you tonight. It's going to be great. Scott, hey, how you doing over there?
I am doing good. I've been busy. Been traveling across the country again. Went to Kansas City this week. And while I was there, I actually got notified about some really cool stuff from PRS Guitars, which I thought was pretty exciting. That I don't know if you saw, I posted it on our Facebook page, but they announced four new models that are below the $500 range for the first time in their history. It's called the SE Standard.
Did you try them?
No, they just came out this week. I haven't been able to try it now myself. I don't think they're in stores yet. But yeah, there's a custom 22, 24. I think it's called the P245, which is that 24.5 scale length guitar, and then the Santana guitar.
Yeah, I see the picture on Facebook. It looks really nice, but they have great wood, and the necks are killer. I'm dying to try one of those. That should be fun.
Yeah, I mean, for $500 to get a PRS, man, and hey, PRS is like one of the big guitars a lot of the country guys are using now. So, and speaking of country, we're talking country today.
That's right. All right, well, listen, let's go ahead and go to commercial. When we get back, let's talk to Steve Trovato, and we're going to hear some interesting guitar playing tonight. So we'll be right back after these words.
Hi, Kenny Burgle here from Sweetwater. We're super happy to support Jeff and Scott and the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show on LA Talk Radio. You can see all the specs and pics of your favorite gear and amazingly low prices online at sweetwater.com or call us at 800-222-4700. Every week, Jeff and Scott welcome heavy experts and industry mavens exploring the coolest guitars and basses, pedals, amps, strings, accessories, everything you need to rock. Sweetwater sells all that cool stuff, so listen to the Flow and then check it out online at sweetwater.com or call one of our pro guitar enthusiasts at 800-222-4700. Don't forget that Sweetwater has 24 months equal payments, no interest financing available too. Check that out at the bottom of every Sweetwater webpage where it says easy financing and hit the red apply now button. Thanks for listening. This is Kenny Burgle and Sweetwater saying rock on with the Flow.
Hey, this is Brent Mason with Jeff and Scott, Flow Guitar Enthusiasts, and enjoyed being on the show, and hopefully we'll get together again, and I'm going to go to bed. It's late. Thanks, guys.
We'll be right back. I wanted the guitar to speak for our next guest, and that's him playing. He's a monster player. I want to welcome in the studio Steve Trovato. It's a pleasure to have you and an honor to have you on the show. Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Great, and it's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, I wanted to do a country show for a while, and everybody just kept telling me, you got to talk to Steve. Go see Steve. Steve's got the sound. Steve's got the licks. He's got the whole bag together. And the clips that you brought me, that you sent me before the show, are just killer. I mean, it was difficult editing them because he's doing just all sorts of really cool things. It was like, well, no, I got to keep that in there. I can't cut that one out. But this first cut was called Squawkin', and it's a great cut. Real quick, though, because your tone is just amazing. What were you using there on that? Do you remember what you were playing and what pedals, if you were using any pedals?
Sure, I can remember that particular cut and that particular solo. I was, speaking of Paul Reed Smith, I was using a Paul Reed Smith for that.
Oh, really?
For that particular chorus. And I was using a Super Overdrive Boss pedal. And I think that's all into some kind of probably a Fender amplifier, as I remember.
Fender amp.
Yeah, just a simple sound. It's amazing what you can get up out of a minimal amount of equipment. It's all in the player in the hands, I think.
Yeah. Well, your tone, I mean, what you were warming up tonight, you have a Tele with you tonight, it's the guitar. It's just really, you know, you've been using some pedals, and we're going to look at that in a minute. But it's basically your guitar and your amp, and it's a great setup. But let's talk a little bit. Let's get a little bit into you so we get an idea where you're coming from. Give us a little background on your playing, early days, influences, and stuff like that.
Sure. I'm from New Jersey, actually, and I grew up playing the guitar. I played piano till I was about six or seven. And then when I was about 13, 14, I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And I realized that I got just as excited seeing George Harrison as ever. And so I picked up a guitar. I dropped the piano and picked up a guitar. And then as I started to listen to other guitar players, I realized that I'm not just interested in one style. I'm voracious and want to learn to play every style. So I started picking out records, and I transcribed everything from Joe Pass to Chet Atkins to George Benson to Pat Martino to, of course, The Ventures and Jeff Beck and pretty much everyone. And long story short, I came out here in 1980 to attend the Musicians Institute in Hollywood. I went there, and by good fortune, I graduated number one in the class, and they immediately asked me to teach there. And I really didn't know much about teaching then, but I asked my mentor, Tommy Tedesco, who was probably one of the most recorded guitarists in history. I said, Tommy, what should I do? I don't know what to do. I've never really taught before. They asked me to be the country guitar teacher, and I didn't even know about country guitar. I'm from New Jersey. So he just told me, he looked at me in the eye, and he said, just say yes. And that has become pretty much the motto for my life. When somebody asks me to do something within reason, I just say yes and figure it out as I'm going along. And so I've got to do so many things by doing that. Since then, I've graduated from the Musicians Institute a long time ago, and then I moved over to the University of Southern California, where I still am today, and I'm fortunate to be with a great faculty, Bruce Forman and Pat Kelly and Frank Potenza, Richard Smith, Nick Stubbs, Tim Cobes, and myself, and we have a great time together in both the studio jazz guitar department and in the newly found Contemporary Popular Music Performance Program.
Oh, okay. So there's a new department just all on that. I remember the studio guitar part. I was there back in the days with Duke. But the I remember it in terms of what we were learning at the time, and especially talking to Duke, who was a session guy, and that was the key thing for sessions, is to be able to play all styles. So when you were working, if you did sessions and stuff, which I mentioned in your bio, did that come in? Did you find yourself being pigeonholed as a country player or a blues player, or were you playing everything?
That's a great question. No, when I graduated from the Musicians Institute, I had played in one of the performance classes, I had played two country songs just for fun. Mm-hmm. And the owner of the school happened that day and at that time to be showing three potential students around the school. And just about the time I started to play my two country songs, which happened to be the theme from Benny Hill and a Root Beer Rag, which I transcribed from a Billy Joel album, mm-hmm. the owner of the school came in and he was showing these two kids around the school and they happened to hear me play that. So they both went back to his office and said, gosh, if we can learn how to play that, we want to come here. And they both signed up and gave him their money that day. So the owner of the school thought I was the country guitar teacher. So he hired me to be the country guitar teacher for the Musicians Institute. And that's when I asked Tommy Tedesco about it, and he just said, say yes. So in a way, I was pigeonholed into it, and I never gave up all the other styles, and I love it. But I go where the opportunities come about.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I remember reading the articles of Tommy Tedesco. He used to write in Guitar Player, and that was you just say yes, and that was his philosophy. He would wing it. I mean, you know, he'd tune a bouzouki into a guitar tuning and play it. And they didn't care, you know. It was great. Yeah.
Well, to Steve's credit, I have to say, I just remembered where I saw him before, because I was just talking to him before that I met him originally at the LA Amp show, and it was at Colby Amps is where I saw him jamming with Dale Kasher. And he was playing jazz, and I would have never thought we were hearing country today, but because he was fantastic at the jazz.
Yeah, and I was looking and going through your bio and stuff. He has videos on blues playing. So obviously, and we talked about this, we're definitely going to have you do so many different styles. There's a lot of different shows we can do with it. But I wanted to do a country show, and everybody just kept saying, "You got to talk to this guy. He's the telly guy. He's the guy that gets that sound. You want to talk to him." So, but anyway, that just means you're going to have to come back. You know that.
I would love to.
Now let's get into country a little bit. I mentioned in the blog that that I posted in on Facebook, that country is just permeated all through. I mean, it was a big influence on a lot of different music, rock included, and it was influenced by stuff. I noticed that a lot of country licks are jazz influenced. There's a lot of jazz scales and phrasing and stuff. And there's a lot of different types of styles. And I wanted to go through, because we're going to play a clip at the end when we go out. It's a song that he did that's basically, it's called Picker's Roundup. And the reason I was going to have you play live coming out, but this song is so cool because he covers all these different styles of country pickers, and he does it all in one song, and it's kind of a monster thing. It's you got to hear it, and we'll put that on it when we at the end of the show. But let's go through that in your interpretation of what you've learned. Kind of go through what the different styles and the different things that you know when you think of country, so we get a kind of a feel of. I don't think this is ever done where we've actually analyzed the country style.
Right, I'd be happy to. I guess it probably started in the 1940s where country and Western musicians started to get together and sing sort of lonesome, lost my girlfriend, lost this, and sad songs. And so they started to sing, particularly in duos, like the Delmore Brothers and the Leuven Brothers. And they needed musicians. But the problem was, there was no guitar players and there was no style, so no one who played guitar really knew what to play. And the only guitar players that were really available were jazz guitar players. Guys like Hank Garland and Eldon Chamblin, and of course Chet Atkins and Merle Travis. And so those were the guitar players that were available. And so those were mostly the players that they used on all these records. So the early country guitar is not how we hear it today, like in a Brent Mason or a Brad Paisley or myself or any of us. It was more of a jazz style. There was a band, probably the innovator of country and bluegrass was a gentleman called Bob Wills. And his band was called the Texas Playboys. And his guitar player was a gentleman named Eldon Chamblin, who came up with his own unique style. And, of course, Merle Travis and Chet Atkins and Jimmy Bryant, all these guys started playing on all these records, and people started noticing the guitar. because it was so good and so different. So the guitar gradually started to assume a bigger role in country till it became a featured instrument. And at that time, a lot of the country guitar players that were still jazz guitar players were now being noticed and began to put out their own recordings. And so they became even more well-known through their recordings. And then there came a time when Chet Atkins started to use other guitar players when he was the president. Chet Atkins, by the way, is probably one of my favorite guitar players of all time. He was one of the gentlemen who started country guitar, and he also was the vice president of RCA Records. I'm sorry. So when he started recording bands like the Everly Brothers in the 60s, even in the 50s, and Merle Haggard, these guys didn't have a lot of money. Because they did not have a lot of money, they bought cheaper guitars, guitars that were durable, guitars that could fall off the back of a truck when they're driving around in the South in the Chitlin circuit and not break. These, of course, weren't jazz guitars because they were A, too expensive, and B, too fragile. So about that time, Mr. Leo Fender started to make these guitars, and he made them specifically for these musicians that were traveling along the Chitlin circuit in the South. And basically, the roads weren't paved, and most of them, and they would drive in a pickup truck, and sometimes they'd hit a bump, and the guitar would fly out of the back of the pickup truck and bounce on the ground. So they would go back to Leo Fender and say, "Leo, can you make me a guitar that won't break when it falls?" And so Leo came up with the Telecaster and the Stratocaster. So the Telecaster and the Stratocaster were originally designed to be jazz guitars, and he made the pickups on them to be very warm and mellow for jazz, but he also put another pickup on that happened to sound really twangy, and it's the bridge pickup on a Telecaster and a Stratocaster. So these guys who were playing jazz, you know, might have hit this one, the bridge pickup by accident one night, and it had a beautiful twang to it. And that twang caught on, especially with guys like James Burton, when he was playing with Rick Nelson, the Everly Brothers. And so that twang sound became popular. And so the jazz players were now using the twang sound, but they were using the jazz style. So hence a lot of the early country sounded like jazz.
Can you demonstrate that? And show us also, too, like the rhythm, or I presume it was the rhythm pickup, was the jazz pickup.
Yeah.
And then show it so you can kind of demo what you just said.
Well, if I play more chords. Nice warm sound out of it. But then if I happen to flip by accident to the bridge pickup,
okay.
And so the Telecaster became one of the most versatile guitars that probably was ever made, and so still today, a lot of people, jazz players and country players and rock players alike, still use Telecasters. And I love mine. I've been using mine pretty much all my life.
Do you tend to use the Tele more than the Strat?
Well, the deal is this, that most musicians that have a name for themselves have a brand.
Mm-hmm.
And so Stevie Ray Vaughan, you always knew he was going to be wearing the white boots, play a Stratocaster, and maybe a hat with a big feather in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that became his brand. People learned to recognize him by that. Jeff Beck always comes out with his T-shirt on and his hair, and everybody knows Jeff Beck by his look. So I decided if I was going to be singled out in any way, it would probably be because of a brand that I decided to try to invent. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to leave all my other guitars home and go out with a Telecaster so people think of me as the Telecaster guy.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, and the answer, long answer to your short question was, yes, I use my Telecaster more than my Strat. But when I'm in the studio, of course, my Strat is at my right side all the time. Mm-hmm. I love it. I have a lot of them.
Now, do you use, we were talking about the sound, they were using the treble pickup and the rhythm pickup, because one of the things that's unique with the Telecaster is using the two pickups. Was that popular back then, to use the two pickups together to get that kind of out-of-phase type of sound, or did that come later?
You know, I'll tell you, that's a great question, but the first time I heard it and the first time some of my buddies heard it was on an album. I think it was in the 70s or 70s. It was an album by Loggins and Messina.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a song in there where they had Jimmy Messina was playing a Stratocaster, but he had this sound that no one had heard before. And so it sounded really unique. So after much experimentation, all these guitar players, the Stratocasters then had a three-position switch. So they found out by wiggling the switch back and forth and moving it and finding just the right spot, they would get that same sound that Jim Messina was using. And so that sound became very popular because it was so unique and had its own voice. And so eventually that led to Fender coming up with a five-position switch so mm-hmm. you could get mm-hmm. it without trying to find it between stops in the switch. So, yes, it's become very popular, and I think that's a well-known sound, and of course it's become its own voice. It's become pretty much the Telecaster's voice. I mean the Stratocaster's voice, rather.
Yeah. Well, I know that, like, Del, you're talking about having Del Casher on the show. He had his Strat wired in he had a special setting where he had the bridge pickup and the pickup next to the fretboard, the rhythm pickup. You know, he had that set up on a Strat, so if he hit one position, it actually did that to duplicate more of the Tele sound. Actually, go ahead, and since we're talking about it, if you can play with the pickup switch, both of them together, so they get an idea of that sound.
Sure.
People thought it was an out-of-phase sound, but it really isn't. It's just the two pickups together.
Yeah, it's just got its own unique sound.
So, let's play a clip. I'm trying to think, we can see what pickups you were using. I'm going to play the Ghost Riders clip because there's some really interesting tones that you have on that. So here's sure. Ghost Riders. I presume that's the Tele, right?
Actually, no, that was a Gretsch.
That was a Gretsch?
That's a Gretsch, one of those orange Gretsches that when I think of Duane Eddy, I think of a Guild or a Gretsch. And I didn't have a Guild, but I have a Gretsch.
Mm-hmm.
So I used the Gretsch on that.
Is that the one with the single pickup? McGrees. I'm having a brain fart here.
You mean
is it like Duane Eddy's where it has the P90 in it?
No, this one had... This one has two TV Jones Gretsch replacement pickups, where he's the guy now, I guess, has been commissioned by Gretsch to make their pickups, the very high-end pickups.
Was that the Nashville, the Gretsch?
So it's like a 6120?
Yes.
Oh, okay. It's a 6120. Because the Chet Atkins Nashville was an orange guitar, too.
Right, of course.
So that's how you got that. Now, do you remember what strings? Because that tone was very common. I heard that a lot on TV themes. And I'm like, that low thing that you're doing, the main Ghostwriter theme, it's like, how did you get that sound? Because I've been, I know, it's not that easy to get that. I mean, I know a lot of it was, well, it was the strings and the guitar, but that tone, the harmonic content of that type of sound was very popular in the 60s. Do you remember what you were using string-wise on that?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't using anything special. I was using a set of D'Addario 10 through 46.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think lent the unique sound to the tone is I was using an Ampeg amplifier with a 15-inch speaker in it. So it just sounded lower and throatier. It sounded more had more depth.
Yeah, it did have a deep sound to it, but yeah.
And I thought, if I wanted a deeper sound, why don't I try a 15-inch speaker so it's automatically got more bottom end?
Mm-hmm.
So that's I just plugged it in, and there it was.
But all those different parts are the Gretsch.
Yeah.
Okay.
Whole thing.
Now, getting back to the different styles, in terms of looking at country, can you kind of show us a little bit of the different types of techniques or styles? Like some of it, what I consider the Chet Atkin thing is like the finger picking type of alternating finger picking with the root and fifth on the bottom that you were playing a little earlier. But I might, maybe that's another style, but I mean, it's hard to explain it. I don't know, but can you kind of show us some of the different influences or the different techniques that you look at as a style?
Sure, I'd be happy to, Jeff. Probably when people ask me for lessons, what I think of first is what sound have you probably heard, are you familiar with, that you want to emulate? Yeah, so I think, well, what's the first sound somebody would hear? It would probably be a twangy Telecaster sound. So the first thing I tell people is to learn some twangy ideas. So what I do first is I just tell them, okay, so we're going to grab a note, and I'm going to chicken pick it. Chicken picking is probably the most popular. So I don't know if I should actually give a lesson here, but real quickly, I'll fret a note, and I'll say A here. I'll put the underside of my third finger.
Okay.
On the underside of the first string, I'll come down with my pick and pick it so I get a percussive thump. Then I snap my middle finger up, and I get the cluck.
So he's using the middle finger to mute it. It's like a mute.
Right. And I'm also using it to play it.
Ah, okay. Okay.
So then I can just start playing a lick down and... And go back and... When I go back and forth, repeat that movement up and down with my pick and middle finger. That's how I get the chicken picking sound.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing I would probably teach someone. The second thing people ask me about is, how do I get that pedal steel sound?
Mm-hmm.
So the pedal steel sound, the best way I can describe that is to... You're going to bend a note against one or two fixed notes. So in other words, if I were in the key of G and I wanted to get a pedal steel sound, I could, for instance, fret the third fret of the second string and then go to the third string and bend the A up to B. So it's going to sound like this. Now, a couple of things to take note of here. When you bend, you have to bend perfectly in tune. Otherwise, it won't sound so good. I mean, in blues, it's okay to be in the vicinity, but in country, you have to be right on it. So what I do, I'm playing the second string with my pinky, and I'm playing the third string with my middle finger, and I'm bending that note up with my middle finger, but I'm also supporting it with my first finger behind it. So I'm in effect using two fingers to push it up to help me support the bend and keep it in tune.
Yeah, because that down there, that's hard to push it, that string. I mean, higher up on the fretboard, it's a little easier, but that's not easy to do.
Yeah, no, that's not easy to do.
So then, now, Steve, do you ever use a B bender?
You know, I have not used a B bender, actually. I love B benders, but it's just there's too much hip wiggling that has to go on. I just want to play. I've learned to pretty much imitate that sound without one.
But you've played one before. You've used it before.
I have used one before, yeah. I like them. A friend of mine, Will Ray, uses one of those. And a lot of people. Albert Lee is probably the best I've ever heard at a B bender. He's just amazing. But I figure I'm never going to sound like that, so I might as well just do my own thing.
Yeah. Well, you get it. I mean, some of the clips that we were listening to, you're actually doing some of that stuff on there.
Yeah, I've learned to imitate that. Well, when I first heard the B bender sound, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know that that's a B bender. I just thought they were playing that. So I tried to figure out how to play it. I spent hours and hours and hours trying to figure out how to do that without a B bender.
Yeah.
And so that's how I learned.
Yeah, I remember when I heard it, Clarence White from the Byrds.
Oh, of course.
And he was doing stuff. I'm like, how did he, you know, I'm trying to think how he fingered that to get that. And it's like, there's no way. And he's like doing these weird bends. And then I found out later it was the B bender. He was another good B bender person.
Fantastic.
So, but you do the bends pretty well. I mean, that you're getting the effect. So, Scott, did you want to ask something? I saw you.
Well, a couple things. I was wondering, does anyone ever ask how to play? I mean, the old kind of like Johnny Cash, kind of Luther Perkins kind of guitar playing. Is that just not common? I mean, it's not common in country music anymore. And I guess kind of along with that is, when did country music become rock and roll? Like, when did it change?
That's a good question. I would say it pretty much changed around 1954, 1955, and the first time that anyone noticed that the electric guitar became twangy and a little more edgy was when a guy in Chess Records, a guy from Chess Records, played a song, he recorded a song called Maybelline, and then he later changed it to Johnny Be Good, and it was Chuck Berry. And so that was one of the first times that I think people heard rock guitar, and then the whole everything changed after that. The jazz guitar went by the wayside. It took its place. It took its place in the ivory tower, and so did blues. And what happened was a lot of the country music has a little bit more of an upbeat feel. So after World War II, people didn't really want to hear depressing, introspective music like the blues. So big bands became popular, and dance bands became popular, and country became popular. So that's when people like Merle Haggard and Buck Owens started this new sound with the guys that originally had probably been jazz players and now switched over to this twang sound that they've learned to like to create something unique that no one had ever heard before. And it pretty much became the standard.
So, I mean, but for modern times, you know, like you go and see Brad Paisley. I mean, he's out there playing, you know, Vox amps, Marshall amps, all kinds of stuff. I mean, when did these guys switch to that rather than playing Fender and Peavey?
Oh, I'll tell you, that's a great question. I'll tell you exactly when that happened. It happened when there was a time, probably late 80s, when country music became more or less, it died a little bit. And so in order to resurrect it and repopularize it, they tended to give it a more rock and roll edge, more rock edge. So I think if you listen to a lot of country music today, it almost sounds like rock music. A lot of distorted guitars, a lot of overdriven guitars, a lot of rock beats, a lot of rock drums. And so what happens is these guys that were playing twangy started to play with these rock sounds, and it only went further. It only went further. So now I have this saying that I call modern country is basically Bruce Springsteen with a cowboy hat. And it just sounds like rock music, hard rock with a Les Paul or with something or a Strat with an overdriven amp, like you say, like a Dr. Z. And so these guys also started to use distortion and overdrive. But they found out that it also sounds great with single coil guitars, especially Telecasters. So then you have guys like Brad Paisley, who come out with this Telecaster with this overdriven sound that is just outrageous. He's amazing. I think he's amazing. So that's when I think it really switched over during the late 80s, early 90s.
Let me, I'm going to play a clip because another part of it too, and maybe you can clarify it because there's so many different styles and it melded. And part of that, you know, like you said, it started taking a rock character, but also too in the 80s, country started crossing over into the pop, the general pop area. There was a lot of singers and stuff in it, and that affected it too. But I'm going to play this piece. It's an interesting, this is DG's Boogie, and it's got it. Well, I'll let it speak for itself. Some of the things that you were talking about, the bending and some of the other, and you kind of took a little, you took the chicken picking a little farther with the, like this little percussive thing. You can hear that in that. But that's kind of, to me, that sounds like a rockabilly thing. How does that, when did that come in? And in the overall country music thing, because that's obviously, rockabilly has definitely got a strong country. I mean, it's evolved from there. Can you talk a little bit about the style, the differences, or how would you classify that?
That song or rockabilly?
Mm-hmm.
Both of them? Or,
yeah, both.
Yeah. That is a little more high-powered than I'd call rockabilly. Rockabilly is a great sound. That's more of a guitar feature than rockabilly. I think rockabilly has been a great addition to music in general. It's just Americana at its finest.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these country players came up and they started playing the rockabilly sound, which of course the rock part of it has the guitar, distorted guitar, slightly overdriven guitars, and the billy part of it is the country side of it. So then we started to meld the sound of country guitars and hillbilly music, country music.
Yeah.
But we didn't want to make the guitars too distorted yet, so we just added a little bit to them, and we added a little edge to them, and we add a little delay. So you got.
It seems like, you know, if you heard rockabilly live and somebody was cranking up their Fender amp, it would just get that little bit of distortion, and it, you know, it gave it more like of a live sound.
Right.
But rockabilly always to me kind of swung, which was kind of a jazz thing. It was,
yeah,
you know, that kind of lazy beat type, mm-hmm, of swinging beat, as opposed to rock was more like on the one and driving. But I mean, is that true, or do you find that it can, you know, I mean, it seemed like it would swing more to me. I mean, at least, you know, the stuff I've heard, like Seltzer or something like.
Right. Well, there's an interesting story, and I tell it every now and again when somebody asks me this very question. When Johnny B. Goode was recorded by Chuck Berry, it was really before rock.
Right.
And so all the musicians that were playing were jazz musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And the jazz musicians came from a swing background.
Mm-hmm.
But Chuck Berry didn't. He didn't know from swing. So if you listen closely to Johnny B. Goode, the guitar is playing straight eights, and the drummer is playing a swing beat.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of these musicians who went on to record with other artists are basically, from their beginnings and their roots, jazz musicians. So they tend to swing everything because that's pretty much the
right.
And so you get a lot of these rockabilly records where the rhythm is being swung, and then some of the rockabilly musicians picked up on that and they said, oh, that's a cool idea. And they started to go with that. And so it basically evolved. It took a long time and it evolved like that, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Now, on that clip that we played, what were you using on that guitar, or those guitars?
That was a, what was that? That was a, I forget, it was some kind of a Telecaster. I remember it was Seafoam Green. And for that one, curiously enough, I used a Groove Tubes amplifier. Mm. And that's another whole story, but I used a Groove Tubes amplifier, and I was, the engineer on that was Eddie Kramer. And if people out there are too young to know who Eddie Kramer was, he was the engineer who recorded most of the Hendrix cuts, most of the Hendrix albums, and Led Zeppelin, and a lot of others. So he was the engineer on that. I don't know how that happened, but I looked up and there was Eddie Kramer. So he made me walk out in the room where the amp was. He stood me back about 25 feet from the amp, and he just dialed different sounds. And he said, "Do you like that? Do you like that? Do you like that?" And I finally got a sound that I liked, which is that slightly overdriven rock tone, which doesn't sound, it sounds bigger and angrier and more aggressive than country. So I like that sound. So Eddie Kramer put about 5 different mics on it, and he still to this day won't tell me what they were. Mm-hmm. And we recorded it, and so that's the sound we got. But all it was a guitar and an amp turned up pretty loud.
Turned up pretty loud.
Until it started to get a little bit edgy.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we used. No pedals, nothing.
Now, you had mentioned that he tell us the story real quick, and I'll play this little segment from that I pulled from the original song about the Leslie.
Oh, this was one of the honors of my life. I was in the studio, and I was actually recording this song. And there was a certain part in the end of this song where I wanted to get a different sound. I wanted to get some sort of a vibrato or a Leslie or something. But I didn't really have the right pedals or the right gear to do it. So it just so happened in the other room, there was a Hammond organ, a B3, with a Leslie speaker. So Eddie looks up and he says to me, "Do you want me to do the same thing that I did for Jimi Hendrix in 1969? I'm going, "Yeah." So he took my guitar and he plugged it in, and somehow he wired me up to that Leslie speaker, the exact tone that Hendrix had in some of his cuts. So it was me playing through a real Leslie speaker, which is great enough, but playing through the Leslie speaker the same way Jimi Hendrix played through it in 1969, set up by Eddie Kramer.
Okay, let's take a listen to that. Here's the clip. Now, actually, for a minute, when I first heard it really quick, I wasn't paying attention. It sounded like an organ player because you were doing some of the riffs that they normally do.
Yeah.
And that was that's a great sound. Yeah, the Leslie.
So, Steve, do you think it's possible that a lot of people think what was Univibe was possibly that setup right there?
You know, that's a question. I wouldn't be surprised at all. I wouldn't be surprised. I would think that it would be a little bit tough for Jimi Hendrix to carry around a Leslie speaker, and it also wouldn't be loud enough. So I would say the Univibe would be a facsimile or a substitute that wouldn't, of course, sound just like that. But it certainly had its unique sound and still holds up today, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to play it. We're almost out of time. I want to play it one more clip, and then I want to go through what you're using tonight, what you brought down tonight. This is a song called Root Beer, and there's the reason I put this on, he plays more than just electric guitar. And this one, it's featured, there's a dobro on here. So let me play Root Beer for you. Thank you. Now, I was going to play that because of some of the other stuff, because you're doing some really nice overdubs on the guitars, too. So I know the dobro came in later, but it was a kind of an interesting pan thing that you did at the end of that. Now, what were you using? What kind of dobro was that, and what were those other guitars? Because that tone was a killer tone.
Well, let me talk about the dobro first. That was, I forget what that was. It was just a regular, just something that I had. I don't remember the name of it, but it was nothing fancy. It wasn't a high-end dobro. It was just something that I had in my car, and I thought, well, this would be interesting to put on there. But the interesting part of that is this song was also recorded, engineered by Eddie Kramer.
Ah.
And if you remember, in the Led Zeppelin albums, in the Hendrix albums, some of the things swept back and forth. They went back and forth between speakers, between right and left, and they would just kind of sweep back and forth. So he did that to that dobro. He made it sweep back and forth between sides to give it this sound that it so much reminds me of Hendrix or Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, because he kind of catches the phrasing and he's moving it back and forth, so it kind of like answers itself.
So I thought when I heard that, that was really unique. I felt like, yes, I have Eddie Kramer doing what he did for Led Zeppelin for me, and it was such an honor to have him there. He's such a great.
Well, he got a great sound out of that. That dobro sounds killer.
Yeah, he knows all the mics to use.
And we won't know. Yeah, he won't tell.
No, he won't tell.
Now, real quick, we're almost out of time. Kind of go through your pedal board real quick so you can tell people what you're using and if you want to just quickly demo something.
Sure.
You got some interesting stuff down there.
Yeah. After many years of experimentation, I just decided I want a simple pedal board that I can grab and go out the door, and it pretty much has all the sounds that I use these days. So I'll tell you what I have. I'm going into a Maxon compressor. And from there, I'm going into a JHS Moonshine pedal. Then from there, I'm going into a Boss Tremolo pedal. From there, I go into a TC Electronics Nova Delay. From there, I go into my favorite pedal, which is a Strymon Deco pedal. And from there, I go into a Fender, a Boss Fender Reverb. And I use that because I don't want to carry a reverb around with me, and I like natural amp reverb. And so when I go to different countries or wherever I go and I get a backline and the amp does not have reverb, I always have it reverb. I always have that ready to go. And then the last pedal that I go through is a JHS Prestige pedal. And that is a bit of a mid-range boost, and it gives a lot of clarity. And basically it's a buffer amp at the end, so all the signal that I'm losing going through all the pedals and all the wiring, when it hits that Prestige pedal, it bumps it all up, so it's got the same strength signal as it did when it went in. So it's just my favorite pedal. It's what I call my always-on pedal. Mm-hmm. So let me go through these one by one. The Maxon Telecaster, I mean the Maxon compressor, is just something that I use to add sustain. That sustain, so when I pick the notes and I'm playing really fast, if I pick one note harder than another note, it will somehow make them, it will compress them and make them all come out at the same volume. And so it makes it sound really poppy, really snappy, like a Telecaster. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys use that. So going on to the next pedal, I use... Well, let's go into the tremolo pedal. I mean, everybody knows what that sounds like. That's a must-have these days. All the pop music has tremolo in it. Everybody knows what that sounds like. And there's a lot of these fancy tremolo pedals on the market, this and that. But for my money, the old Boss tremolo, you can step on it. It's always working. You can drop it. It works. The next pedal I want to talk about really quickly is this JHS Moonshine pedal. I asked Josh from JHS. I said, Josh, I have a Telecaster and I want to play blues and have it rock way up high in the neck, but just the nature of a Telecaster, it sounds thin way up high with overdrive on it. And he said, well, why don't you try one of these moonshine pedals? It's an overdrive. It's got plenty of overdrive and it's also got a 2 dB boost on it. So you can get it to sound really fat on the top end. So if I'm playing a Telecaster up here, and I hit this pedal, I
fattens it up.
It fattens it up and gives it a nice sound. So when I crank that up, it really sounds great. And then my next pedal is my my Nova Delay, and I use that for a lot of different things. But the thing I really like it for is this delay trick that I learned from Albert Lee, where if I go, I go. I set it for a dotted eighth, and I tap the tempo in, and somehow when I play staccato eighth notes, it comes out like that. And I can sound like I'm playing twice the number of notes that I am.
That sounds cool.
Then I'll move on to the Strymon, the deco pedal. The deco pedal basically has a tape. It's two track tape recorders. Basically, they used to do it in the 60s where they would get a nice rockabilly sound using two tape decks and slowing one down slightly than the other one. So if I play that and I put that pedal on with one slapback, I can get that. Get that nice slap back. Then the other added feature of the deco pedal is that it's got an amp saturation, tape saturation overdrive on it, so I can get that nice Stones type rhythm. It's got a nice edge on it, so I use that for a rhythm sound. I can add that to the rockabilly sound I get. And I just love those two sounds together. Then, of course, my last one is the reverb pedal, and everybody knows what that sounds like. And, of course, my last one, the Prestige pedal. When I put it on, it gives the notes a nice definition and a nice evenness. If I turn it off, it sounds a lot less... To me, it sounds a lot less good. And so, now...
Yeah, it gives that lower, like, little throatier sound.
What I've noticed is that the difference between a good sound and a great sound is about 3%. And so, when I use these pedals, it's not to try to get a dramatically better sound. It's just to get to that one place. There's something that happens, I think, in a human when you're listening to music. If you're hearing a great sound, it does something that hearing a bad sound doesn't do. Hearing a bad sound, just it doesn't make you feel good. It doesn't make you feel comfortable. It doesn't make you relax. And you can't really listen to the music. You're too busy being preoccupied by the sound. But I think a good sound is what we all strive for, of course. And I think with this simple combination of pedals and the amp I use, which is a Carp amp, and I think I can get a pretty good sound from that. And it, you know, you put it up with another amp and another set of pedals, it sounds almost as good. But there's that 3% that makes all the difference in the world. That's my sound.
Yeah, and I just want to mention that he's using basically his amp in this situation, and a lot of times now, is clean. He's getting all the distortion from his board when he needs it. So he dials it all in as needed. So. Well, I told you it was going to go by really fast. We are out of time, and we just scratched the surface. We definitely have to have you come back. This is just incredible, and I want to thank you again for coming on the show. It's really a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm going to leave everybody with this clip. It's called Picker's Roundup, and he goes through the different styles. And take a listen to this. It's really, really good, and I think you're going to enjoy it, but it kind of shows the versatility and what you're talking about. Like you said before, that you learned all the styles. It really shows that. It's a great showcase. Anyway, we're out of time. Thank you so much, Scott. I will see you next week.
And again, as always, thank you, Sweetwater.
Yes, and actually, I think all of these pedals they can get at Sweetwater. So check
yeah,
it
probably
out.
They can get those new SE standards too.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Well, we're gonna have to do a show on that. We gotta find. I want to try one of those.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and we will have you back. That's a for sure. Anyway, good night, everybody. This is Picker's Roundup. Check this out.
Down in Nashville at the Opera Show, where all the guitar pickers go, everyone is having a ball. Let's hear a little bit from old Les Paul. Everyone is here tonight, playing it loud and playing it right. Old Ernest Tubb's most famous words, I'll pick it out, Billy Bird. So fine, he played his guitar all the time. His name is known around the world. Let's hear a little bit from old Merle. Now Johnny Cash, as you all know, took this boy wherever he'd go. You'd recognize this country lick when you hear old Luther start to pick. Loved by all the guitar pickers, long and tall. I'm sure you'll recognize him. Let's hear a little bit from Chet Atkins. Guitar men. Well, Steve's the boy that played them all. Let's turn them loose. He's in the hall.